Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. President Trump rallying the faithful in New Mexico last night, signature Trump rally, and he got right after it being the gray lady, the New York Times, that is, and their fallacious story about Brett Kavanaugh over the weekend, which carried into yesterday's discussion, President Trump taking aim at the New York Times.
They use Democrat prosecutors and phony congressional committees whenever they can. They'll do whatever they can to demean you, to libel you. They try to blacklist, coerce, cancel, or destroy anyone who gets in their way. Look at what they're doing today to Justice Kavanaugh. Look at what they're doing. Did you see the New York Times? Did you see what they're doing? Did you see what Democrats? They're calling for his resignation. They're calling for his impeachment. And the woman involved said she didn't know anything. She doesn't. But they still. So the New York Times had to put out a major apology. And they had to change their story. The woman said, I don't remember that. Okay, Blake? And they still want him to be impeached. And I just put out a statement, and he's a great man, by the way, great talent, a great, brilliant man, Brett Kavanaugh. And I just put out a statement on social media that said, I don't think they'll do it, but they should, for the good of the nation. I call for the resignation of everybody at the New York Times involved in the Kavanaugh smear story.
Yeah, I mean, it is journalism 101, Dan. If you don't do a story if an alleged victim says it did not happen, then that's a dead story. That's what you call it, and it's not pursuable.
Well, it wasn't supposed to be a story. It was supposed to be an excerpt from the book that is available today from two New York Times reporters, Kate Kelly and Robin Pogrebin.
Did you get me a copy?
I have not been able to pick one up quite yet. And they were on with one Larry O'Donnell.
Oh, gosh. Well, that guy?
Yeah.
Where's the hammering? Will you stop the hammer guy?
Stop the hammering.
Yeah. All right. Well, stop the hammering, Larry. Just take it easy. We've got more important matters to tackle. Kate Kelly and Pogrebin, describing what happened, what they submitted to the New York Times to preview their book, an excerpt from their book, included that passage that the alleged victim didn't recall the alleged incident. Here's Kate Kelly describing how that went down.
There was zero intent to mislead anybody about the details of the incident. That excerpt that we ran in the Times was an adaptation of what's in our book that you just described so aptly. It really focuses on the experience of Deborah Ramirez, as we understand it, after Robin spending quite a bit of time with her. We included the additional detail about this other as yet unreported allegation because it seemed germane to the type of thing we were talking about. It was a somewhat similar incident.
In your draft of the article, did it include those words that have since been added to the article?
It did.
And her colleague, Robin Pogrebin, explains how this was an editorial decision. But again, no harm intended, just the haste of the moment to publish an excerpt.
I mean, I think what happened actually was that, you know, we had her name and, you know, the Times doesn't usually include the name of the victim. And so I think in this case, the editors felt like maybe it was probably better to remove it. And in removing her name, they removed the other reference to the fact that she didn't remember it. Yeah, I mean, we think we felt like this. There was so much heat. You know, there's so much, everyone has been kind of seizing on various aspects of this that we certainly didn't want this to be an issue anymore. And we certainly never intended to mislead in any way. We wanted to give as full a story as possible.
Believe that? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. And when I asked, do you believe that?
Yeah, what aspect?
Not the reporters, not the two authors of this book, the editorial decision, just an innocent mistake. In the haste of the moment to publish the excerpt, they removed the individual's name, and then they accidentally removed the part about that individual not recalling the incident in question.
It is, that is, they have blood in the water for President Trump, and they see 2020 coming fast right around the corner, and they're desperate to do anything to take him down and his Supreme Court nominees. And this is so egregious and so irresponsible that I actually believe President Trump when he says that they anyone involved in the story should be fired.
Well,
or
I mean,
just get rid of the gray lady altogether. It's ran its course. We're done with you. It's a smut. It's smut.
Well, you don't have to get rid of it. I mean, if you can, if you want, I'd say
throw them all in jail.
Okay.
He should. I mean, at the very least, there should be a lawsuit filed against them.
Well, the issue of having them resign. Not the reporters necessarily, although I'm certainly not absolving them, but forget the ideology here. I'm going to take them at their word. It was an innocent mistake. Okay. Well, then that editor or editors who made that decision, they should be fired on a competency basis. How do you read through that excerpt from the book? And if you're going to include an allegation, remove the part where the alleged victim denies or doesn't recall at all the alleged incident. That's a material fact that would be important in the vignette that you're going to include, particularly since it's included in the book, as at least as we understand from the authors. I haven't read it, but I'll take them at their word. It's included in the book. So that is rank incompetence at best by the editor at the New York Times who made that decision. And so I agree with President Trump that individual should be fired just based on competence if the New York Times cares about such things. I'm not saying they do. Washington Post said on Monday, no fan of the administration, in case you hadn't heard, that they had heard last year of this sexual assault allegation that we're discussing, the individual who doesn't recall said incident. But opted not to publish the claim over concerns that the story was too thinly sourced. Too thinly sourced for the Amazon Post. But we'll take a shot over at the Gray Lady. We'll take a swing, see what happens.
It's unbelievable.
By the way, the story about, this book in total, their focus on Deborah Ramirez and whatever additional context about Deborah Ramirez's time at Yale. And by the way, one of the authors, Robin Pogrebin, also a Yale graduate. I think she was there around the same time as Kavanaugh. She's going to learn all about Yale culture and Deborah Ramirez's story. And that's all well and good.
Yeah, but Deborah Ramirez and her attorney turned down several requests to testify in the Kavanaugh hearings and they didn't show up.
That's right. Leland Kaiser, high school friend of Christine Blasey Ford.
Yeah.
Ex-wife of Bob Beckel. She's no conservative either. She has now cast additional doubt on Blasey Ford's claims.
Oh, good.
Telling the New York Times reporters, Pogrebin and Kate Kelly, in their book, I don't have any confidence in the story. She doesn't refute Dr. Ford's account, says Kaiser's attorney. She's already told the press that she believes Ford's account. However, the simple unchangeable truth is that she's unable to corroborate because she has no recollection of the incident in question. well, I don't have any confidence in the story is not exactly believing Dr. Ford's account. It's saying at best that I'm neutral on it. Pogramed and Kelly report that actually Kaiser has gone further than her attorney described last year. She challenged Ford's accuracy. This is according to the book forthcoming from these two New York Times reporters. And CBS News, to their credit, and I'll give credit where credit is due, Jan Crawford at CBS News filed a report yesterday making this point.
Speaking publicly for the first time to the Times reporters, Ford's close friend Leland Kaiser, who Ford said was at the party, said she didn't believe Ford's account and that it just didn't make any sense. She also said she told the FBI that Ford's allies pressured her to say otherwise.
Now, all four people that Ford identified as being at that high school party in the summer of 1982 have now said no such party occurred. And today, both the Republican chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee and the Democratic chair of the House Judiciary Committee said they would not support impeaching Kavanaugh.
You just lost Jerry Nadler.
Wow.
What do you got? The four people Blase Ford identified all say never happened.
And that there wasn't even a party. That's big news.
Will we be getting apologies from the luminaries on the Senate Judiciary Committee, who you'll recall the Sheldon Whitehouses and the Amy Klobuchars, the T-Bone Bookers and the Reparation H's? Will we get apologies from them?
I mean, it is so.
Are we going to hear the Democrat Socialists that were screeching for impeachment of Kavanaugh over the weekend? Is that going to continue? I'll tell you what, this is a full boomerang on the left. And as much as possible, this should be held up the same way Trump held it up yesterday as an example of the reckless disregard for the truth that the cultural Marxists, that the socialist candidates for president, that the leadership of the left have in pursuit of destroying political opponents.
And all this does is help Trump in 2020, really, because everybody knows, and they will eventually realize, even those on the left, that this was nothing more than a witch hunt. Even Christine Blasey Ford's dad, who belongs to the same golf club as Kavanaugh's dad, said, "We believe you and we stand behind you." They don't believe their own daughter. That's bad.
Dan in Plainfield, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, folks. I have a feeling that this is something to go about with Ruth Ginsburg, future for Supreme Court. This is just like a warning shot to the future nomination that President Trump will give to the person. And then with what's going on with what you hear on with the book and everything, I think this is just saying, hey, this is what you guys are going to get if you try to be one of the Supreme Court's nominees.
That's part of it. Thanks for the call, Dan. They've set the tone of what will come if President Trump were able to name another nominee to replace Ginsburg, to replace Breyer, and further shift the balance of the court. I'm sure some of those names on the short list, like Amy Coney Barrett, are well aware of what she is in for were she to be nominated. There's something else, though, and I agree with Kyle Smith, who writes about this in National Review. We mentioned this at the time, going through the Kavanaugh saga, that whole imbroglio. This is a political project. It's an element of a political project, and it's not just the warning shot of what's to come for the next not Trump nominee, if there is one. It is to run interference on Roe v. Wade, to intimidate the likes of a Brett Kavanaugh from ruling to overturn Roe v. Wade, to put an asterisk next to their name and try to essentially apply a permanent blemish on his record that would encourage him to stay the course on Roe v. Wade, lest he go down in Supreme Court history in an ignominious fashion by those who will write it. That's what this is about. It's part of a political project. Tom in Deer Park.
Yes, Dan, that assessment's correct, and they can all do it because there's just no consequences. There's no going back. There's no walking back. There's no apologizing. Yesterday, I called in and I commented that a couple of our locals here, Eric Zorn and Rex Hupke, Eric Zorn specifically, subtweeted our congressman from the Illinois 6th here, who was in town yesterday, that was, again, taking advantage of these re-upped charges that were subsequently taken back by the New York Times. And you look throughout the day for a walk back, a delete, something, nothing. As a matter of fact, what the playbook, and the playbook, unfortunately, I think where they learned it from, I don't like it, but where they learned it from is just to go on the offense. And Eric Zorn puts out a column about the Bears kicker talking about thanking God after the big kick. So they're doing it. They learned it, deflection and diffraction and denial and just move on. And unfortunately, it's the culture we live in, but there's no consequences for it. And thanks for doing what you do on your show.
Well, thanks for the call, Tom. Well, Zorn, probably no consequences except on us. He'll probably follow his column up with some god-awful folk song that he likes to write, pretend to be a musician, hack that he is, pathetic. It's embarrassing. He's an embarrassment to the Chicago Tribune, but there are many. Now, Sean Kasten's another matter. Sean Kasten has to stand for re-election in 2020. Sean Kasten, you just lost Jerry Nadler on Kavanaugh. And Sean Kasten's reckless disregard, lack of interest for anything resembling due process when it comes to political opponents. How do you like that in the Western Burbs? How do you like that in Hinsdale? Clarendon Hills? DuPage County? How do you like your Sean Kasten now?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2 on AM 560, The Answer.
.312-642-5600, Turnkey Debt Pro Answer Line, 646-36-DA. Phone lines and text lines are open. Do you stand in solidarity with the UAW? Or are you pretty persuaded that GM's management is offering a square deal? Here's some of the highlights of what management has offered and what the United Auto Workers, on behalf of their somewhat 150,000 members, 73,000 at GM, have declined. Right now, UAW workers pay 3% contribute 3% for their health insurance coverage, compared with 29% for workers on average in the private sector, according to a study published by the Kaiser Foundation. They pay 3%, average 29%. UAW has proposed to keep that their health insurance contribution at 3%. They have offered, has GM, to build, to make $7 billion in new U.S. factory investments, new jobs, higher pay, proposal for idle plants in Michigan and Ohio. They also have solutions for two of the biggest factories, assembly plants in Lordstown, Ohio, and Detroit. Company negotiators have put on the table a plan that could keep the Detroit Hamtramck factory open to eventually build an electric pickup truck facility. In addition to that, what UAW wants, I should say, among other things on the wage side, is they want raises for entry-level workers who currently start at just under $20 an hour to get them to $30 an hour in 3 to 4 years instead of the current period of 8 years. So they want a 50% increase in wages for entry-level workers over the course of a three-year deal.
And they want job security for them, too.
Well,
I want to make sure that...
Of course.
Yeah.
GM workers were also offered a signing bonus of $8,000 per member.
Whoa.
To ratify the deal that was proposed by GM. $8,000 per member, plus wage gains or lump sum payments in all 4 years of the contract. healthcare contributions the same, and commitment to invest in the company, to build new facilities, to open shuttered facilities, which provide more jobs and, frankly, more union members. Now, again, I mentioned at the end of the show yesterday, the UAW is in quite the curious situation here. Well, the president of the union, Gary Jones, is under federal criminal investigation. His former executive assistant has been indicted for embezzling union funds. And the previous president, who preceded Gary Jones, is also part of that federal criminal investigation into illicit activities at the highest levels of UAW. And these are the gentlemen you'd like to put in charge of your career path and financial future.
If they were my union leaders, I wouldn't walk out. I'd stay on the job.
They got your back, do they?
Yeah, sure. No, they have their own back. They're lining their own pockets with your union dues, dummies.
Well,
I mean, wake up. It's such a scam.
It's interesting. I mean, it's a bit of a difficult position for the president because I think a lot of these rank and file UAW members are Trump voters. But of course, he doesn't want to see plants shuttered. He doesn't want to see GM losing $100 million a day in EBITDA. But so it's hard for him to intercede. Plus, he can't force GM to offer something they don't want to offer. They can't finance, and he can't force the workers to take something that their union apparently has convinced them is unworthy of them. This is an interesting development, not only for the health of our economy and for all of these UAW workers and for all of the plants and the states that in which these plants reside. It's also a bit of a foreshadowing about what may be coming as soon as next week here in Chicago with the teachers.
It's a joke. Yeah.
Craig in Mount Greenwood, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan and Amy. Listen, I have a hunch that these union leaders that are super strong leftists, they're always on the other side, basically being these Democrats and that, and they're always pushing the union, body, the actual blue collar workers, to vote Democrat and all that kind of thing. It's probably a scheme that they can just, what you were talking about. These are Trump voters. The union is behind, like, really promoting this and basically stirring this thing up to have these union workers vote the wrong way and everything. They do it all the time. And basically what the money that they make and everything is all good. They're way above what people are making for same kind of jobs everywhere in that. And the GM was being the good one. Anyways, they were getting all kinds of, like, an increase and everything like that. So there's something else to it. And I think it's all political. And when you're talking about the teachers, they're probably going to try to pull the same shenanigan. The left busts up everything, destroys everything, and basically does everything that is illogical. These people were all getting increases in it. They only pay 4% on their health care, and they're basically striking. I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
Thanks for the call, Craig. I mean, you were a member of the union for a long time, Amy, over at NBC5. I was.
Oh yeah,
I was
a union member
for a little while at WLS because yes, close shop.
SAG-AFTRA.
Yeah, that's right. What do you think? Are you standing in solidarity?
I always question. Well, even when I worked as a reporter in Detroit, I always question, well, where are my union dues going? Because it's a lot of money. People don't realize it's tens of thousands of dollars that you give to your union. And what is it going toward? No one could ever answer that question. Well, you know, we have an office that'll go to your pension, blah, blah, blah. Okay. We didn't have any scandals with after SAG that I know of. But
yeah.
It's just a very large amount of money, and you're trusting people you don't know. Well, kind of like government.
It's interesting.
You're giving the government your money, too, and you don't really know if you can trust them, especially here in Chicago.
It's interesting that GM is proposing both pay increases and job increases. That's abnormal. Milton Friedman, in a lecture some 40 years ago, made the point that the only way in which a group of workers through union organization can increase the amount of its pay is to make sure that there are fewer jobs available. There's no way which a union can simultaneously increase the number of jobs and the pay. The law of demand in economics is inescapable. Can't get rid of it. Raise the price of anything and fewer people will buy it. Right. I think we had that experience recently with the GM bailout, their inability to underwrite the pension obligations they undertook with respect to their labor. This is sort of goes back to this whole idea. You know, the people who write the blank checks on somebody else's account, they're the compassionate ones. People who make promises that they know they can't finance, they're on your side, right? That's what Johnny Lunchpail and Sally Housecoat and the champagne socialists who pretend to be down with the struggle tell you. I'm a good person. I care about the working man and woman, because what I did is I gave them everything that they said they wanted. Now, we have no ability to finance that, so at some point in the not-too-distant future, we're going to be over a cliff, and we're going to end up not keeping our promises. But hey, up front, I'm the hero in the story. I gave them the raises, and we came together, and I love you, and you love me, because we're all celebrating the blank check that you can't cash. What do you think?
312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, and then a quick comment.
Why do you think, I mean, you know, I'm a proponent of collective bargaining rights. You want to organize? Fine. No problem. But there is sort of the real-world experience we find in right-to-work states versus non-right-to-work states like Illinois, their GDP growth, the wages actually in those right-to-work states as compared to their counterparts in non-right-to-work states, because closed shop states. Because, you know, you can prop up those wages artificially for a time, but when you're, as Milton Friedman pointed out, artificially raising the cost of doing business, then you're putting yourself in an uncompetitive position relative to the market. And ultimately, there's going to be a market reckoning there. And that's what's happened over and over again in the car industry that's been, subject to protectionist policies, many self-imposed, admittedly, for the better part of the 20th century. The blank check mentality, though, is what always amazes me. Everybody is going to be down with the struggle for the UAW because they're the little guy, perception-wise. Everybody is going to be down with the struggle for the teachers, just as they were the last teacher strike, because, you know, they're up against big bad city hall. I mean, I understand the last strike, Tiny Dancer is an unsympathetic figure, so it's easy to play personality politics. But what about the economics of it? I say again, in a state with the largest unfunded pension liabilities in the country, in a state where you have Chicago public school teachers who, those that are maxing out in terms of their years of service, mm-hmm. will have put essentially $50,000 into their pension and receive a guaranteed $2.1 million back.
I mean, it's insane.
And they're the little guys, and I'm supposed to celebrate them writing blank checks on my account. Or I'm a bad person. I'm anti-teacher. I'm anti-auto worker. I'm a anti-cop or firefighter. Blank check, that's a representation of your empathy and support for your fellow man. Is it? When Enron Accounting visits government, you think people aren't going to get hurt? And when they do, are those people who made those promises they knew were not financeable, are they still going to be your heroes?
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy email on the UAW strike. The fact that their president is under investigation means little to me, because my president has been under investigation since before he took office. Give me a break.
That's a stretch, please.
Does it matter to you that the executive assistant for the president, former, has been indicted for embezzling union funds? I mean, to compare the two investigations is absurd. But, of course, this individual is union tried and true. Just before I took office as president of my union local, I went to a treasurer president training program. After learning all the little things involving running a union that could get you put in jail if you made mistakes, I damn near nearly resigned before I took office. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, not taking union funds for personal use is not that complicated, friend. What I did do is put a good labor law attorney on the payroll. Having him on retainer not only protected my ass, it provided my membership with free legal services. I know whenever our contracts were up for renewal, the media always had their facts wrong about what we wanted, what we already had, and what we were going to lose. I don't imagine they have any of the facts any more right about this labor dispute than they did about the ones I was involved in. Well, I appreciate your stilted comparisons and fact-free skepticism. However, there hasn't really been dispute by the union, by UAW, in terms of what GM has put out into the public arena with respect to the offerings they've made. So there is that. Frank in Arlington Heights, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Well, good morning, Dan, Amy. On the teacher stuff, I think that, you know, the Republicans are not going to attract anybody by attacking everybody like this. I mean, the math is wrong, number one. You know, when you're a teacher, you put in 9%, and it winds up being, like for me, it's going to wind up being $250,000 by the time I'm done.
Frank,
plus there's an employer match.
Excuse me.
$250,000.
Excuse me.
No, you listen to it. There's the time value of money.
You want to say that I got my numbers wrong. I don't. The Chicago Teachers Union, we were talking about Chicago, 9% contribution, half of which has been picked up by CPS for the last 30 years. So it's actually 4% what CTU teachers put in. So it's different than in the suburbs. So you got your math wrong.
No, if the Chicago, if in districts like Chicago that pay part of it.
Gotta go, Frank. Thanks for the call.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, Indiana officials calling for a federal investigation into the deceased abortionist George Klopfer, who had been stripped of his medical license in Indiana some 3 years ago. This is the individual, the story broke over the weekend. More than 2,000 fetal remains found on his property in Will County.
2,246 fetuses, to be exact. And Will County authorities are very tight-lipped on this, Dan, but one source told me that it took days to count how many fetuses there were, and that these were late-term abortions, most of them.
Governor.
And it's just a ghoulish, just described it as in his 30-plus years in law enforcement is the most ghoulish, grotesque thing he has ever seen.
Why? I mean, it's just tissue masses. Isn't it? It's just baby taxidermy. What's the big deal? I mean, it's just the stuff that Planned Parenthood traffics in. You know, you cut them up and you traffic them in it. Is that too gross? Is that too ghoulish? Eric Holcomb, governor of Indiana. I'm deeply disturbed that more than 2,000 fetal remains were found at the Illinois home of a deceased former Northern Indiana abortion doctor. Doctor's generous. I support calls for a federal investigation. So you've got members of Congress and the governor of Indiana calling for a federal investigation. I don't think you'll get that in Illinois.
Well, Kwame Raoul is teaming up with the attorney general from Indiana. Are you ready for this? Because they want to know if he illegally transported body parts from one state to another. Well, yeah, he did. Yeah, let's have an investigation on that.
Bishop Daniel Conlin, Joliet Diocese, put out a statement. Like many others, I was horrified to learn about the discovery of the remains of over 2,000 unborn children in the home of a deceased abortionist in Crete. Sadly, such an atrocious offense is an unavoidable consequence to treating life in the womb as non-human persons. Unavoidable consequence. You agree? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Bishop Conlon went on to say, I've asked our staff in the Office of Human Dignity and the Catholic Conferences to offer our assistance to authorities and other compassionate organizations in order to ensure that those children are laid to rest with the peace and dignity that every human being deserves.
I just find it, and that's a beautiful thing for them to do because they deserve it. And yesterday, a former patient, Serena Dykson from Fort Wayne, came forward because she wants her baby back, Dan.
That shock turned into lying in bed sobbing at the thought of my baby being on his property. If he could have the babies all these years later, I have a right to know if she was one of them.
She got an abortion from him, late-term abortion, years ago, and she is now pro-life and has come forward and is horrified that he's possibly had her child there for all these years. Kevin Bolger has been hired by the doctor's wife, who had no idea that he was bringing home baby body parts.
They're shocked, and they're doing the best they can to cooperate with the authorities and make sure that everything's appropriate.
You know that, reason, well,
I know
Gosnell's wife didn't know. The reasonable mannequin from the Mishawaka Macy's men's department there running for president, former South Bend, well, current South Bend mayor.
Yeah, current. He's never there, but he's the mayor.
Pete Buttigieg, biblical scholar. He's had a very interesting history defending the mill at which this doctor, abortionist, plied his trade. Whole Women's Health is the name of it. That's not too Orwellian. He renewed his support as recently as last month, citing his deep concern over a, quote, new and extreme assault on Roe v. Wade. Is that what's new and extreme going on at the abortion mill that Mayor Pete supports? In addition to that, in April of last year, Mannequin Pete vetoed a South Bend Common Council rezoning decision that would have allowed a pro-life pregnancy center, women's care center, to open next door to Whole Women's Health, the abortion mill. Mannequin Pete told the South Bend Tribune he didn't find it responsible.
Oh, really?
To situate the two organizations literally right next to each other, despite Women's Care Center's promise not to allow protesters to stage demonstrations on their property. I wonder if Whole Women's Health provided the same promise. I doubt it. Women's Care Center went on to open across the street, just a few dozen steps away from the originally proposed location. It's not uncommon, by the way, for pregnancy care centers to open near abortion mills.
Yeah, that's common.
And it's sort of patently obvious why. So that that woman that you mentioned who had the late-term abortion and regrets it can make a different decision so she doesn't have to live with that regret.
But it's so ghoulish. I mean, why? And that's what Indiana Right to Lifers were questioning yesterday when they met in Fort Wayne.
Why were these babies being preserved? When and where did these babies die? We cannot just shake our heads at the horror of this discovery and then walk away.
Look away. Look away. We don't want to have to confront the vices that we've allowed to metastasize, do we? No. Look away. It's just an abstraction. It's just a choice. You know, some of those babies probably would have been born into families that don't make at least $100,000 a year. So it's probably better. Right? Think about all the arguments you hear in favor of the disposability of life and now apply it to the 2,200 kids found on this guy's property. How compelling are they now?
And more were found in a nearby garage, too.
Dr. Leanna Wen, the recently fired former president of the Mothership for Ghouls, Planned Parenthood. Mm-hmm. Been following her story, you know, she was fired basically because she didn't want to lead with abortion.
Right. We talked about that.
She wrote a 1,400-word letter to Planned Parenthood's board of directors last week, obtained by the New York Times, which includes some pronouncements like, no amount of money can ever buy my integrity and my commitment to the patients I serve, blah, blah, blah. She's an ex-Baltimore health commissioner. But she offers some interesting insights in that letter about Planned Parenthood. Boy, if Dr. Wen converted, that would be almost like a former Planned Parenthood president. That would almost be like huge. Norma McCorvey converting, Roe from Roe v. Wade converting to being a pro-life activist. I'm not so optimistic about it. She doesn't indicate anything of the sort in her letter. I want to make it clear. And this is in the context of a dispute over her severance package. But still, she, in the letter, she wrote that she believed de-emphasizing abortion care is the best way to protect it. However, there's a vocal minority, including many national staff and board members, who prefer a stridently political abortion-first philosophy. You don't say, Dr. Wen. That surprised you, Dr. Wen. Have you been paying attention? Did you pay attention to Planned Parenthood under the stewardship of Cecil the Lion? Cecile the Lion, I guess, was her name. Cecil the Lion was the actual lion. Cecile the Lion, L-Y-I-N, apostrophe. Remember her? Of course it's abortion first. That's where the money is. And not to mention, that's the political North Star for these rabid pro-abortion individuals. Just interesting, the public fight. Now it's a public fight between the former president of Planned Parenthood and what she's describing about the organization and the basis for her termination, no pun intended, in the context of now this potential Gosnell number two. Now, it could be just as simple as this guy, this abortionist, too cheap. He didn't want to pay the burial costs.
Right, because in the state of Indiana, you're mandated to bury the fetuses or cremate. But that's not the impression that I got.
Well, what kind of depravity exists in the mind of somebody that commits violence every day? Who knows?
He's a sociopath.
Scooter on the south side.
Hey, Dan and Amy. No kidding around here, okay, guys? I think we should take these specimens, these human specimens, line them up in front of the Democrats and that big head in the big office in Springfield, and let them decide which one is not a human being. I want to see this. Let them decide which is not a human being. I don't think they could.
Thanks for the call, Scooter. Jeff in Berwyn.
Greetings, Dan and Amy. Over the last 45 years, abortion has become the perfect example of the slippery slope. You know, it's only supposed to be the first trimester. Now they want to murder newborn babies. How long is it going to be before they start advocating for the euthanization of old people, say over the age of 80? Because, you know, they're not working, they're not paying taxes. They're sucking up all that Social Security and Medicare money that could be better given to, the illegal immigrants. When does it stop?
Mm-hmm.
That's all I have to say.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Shout your abortion. It's a celebratory event, according to Planned Parenthood and the pro-abortion activists, those women running around with the pea hats on their heads, those deep intellects running around with pea hats on. Shout your abortion. Wasn't that the campaign? Chip in St. Charles.
I think there should be a law that all abortion doctors should have their homes randomly searched twice a year looking for fetuses, because if these ghouls, if this is how they're going to act, the public has to be defended against it.
Thanks for the call, Chip. I'd be happy just to have the clinics regulated the same way any other medical facility is regulated by the state. I mean, again,
right, and he was shut down and he wasn't allowed in Indiana or Illinois because he wasn't following the rules.
Well, right.
He did perform two late-term abortions on two 13-year-old girls.
He had his license revoked. Indiana, probably one of the better states, right, when it comes to oversight here. I mean, Illinois hasn't looked at any of these Planned Parenthood mills in decades. I said it yesterday. I'll say it again. There are two things that the left promotes should be completely unregulated to the point of lawlessness: America's borders and abortion mills. What does that tell you? Randy in Lake Geneva.
Yeah, baby on board things on cars. I was wondering if the baby not aborted on board would be a little more disturbing to the left.
All right. Thanks for the call, Randy. It's a little ghoulish in its own right and a little dated. Do people still have baby on board signs on their cars?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right, you have to take those down.
And then the little stick figures of how many people are in your family. And now they're putting their pets on. And I did see a goldfish the other day, and I'm not making that up.
I don't like those adornments, and I don't care that your kid is an honor student. It's in middle school.
I think you're a little jealous because your hypothetical children aren't honor roll students yet. Dan.
Chuck and Delavan.
Chuck.
My mom and dad never had one of them bumper stickers that said I was an honor student.
I believe you.
Hey, you know what? Where's the IRS? Was this guy getting paid cash? And then this guy had help. He had to have somebody digging all them graves and stuff. And what did he do in the wintertime? This thing is horrendous. You know, and they should call for a federal investigation. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
They weren't
Chuck.
There was no digging involved. They were stored.
All
my stores will tell me it's driving me crazy.
But medically preserved. Medically, so it sounds like in a jar with formaldehyde, right? Mm-hmm. Something akin to that.
Yes.
Candace in Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin.
Based on what the guy said a couple calls back, how about we take those and pin them on Rauner's doorstep, that male feminist and his man-wife who implemented that, you know, for taxpayers to pay for oblivion in Illinois. I think she should be reminded of what she's done.
Thanks for the call, Candace. There's a lot of credit to go around.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
I am told this is a garbage disposal.
An AM 560.
It is terrifying. I don't know what its purpose is.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard.
The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. President Trump in Rancho Rio, New Mexico, rallying the faithful last night. And he tackled the New York Times' latest smear job on Brett Kavanaugh. But he used Brett Kavanaugh as an example of what the left does and is doing. And I think his statement about their MO when it comes to politics was spot on and important to fully assimilate.
They use Democrat prosecutors and phony congressional committees whenever they can. They'll do whatever they can to demean you, to libel you. They try to blacklist, coerce, cancel, or destroy anyone who gets in their way. Look at what they're doing today to Justice Kavanaugh. Look at what they're doing. Did you see the New York Times? Did you see what they're doing? Did you see what Democrats? They're calling for his resignation. They're calling for his impeachment. And the woman involved said she didn't know anything. She doesn't. But they still. So the New York Times had to put out a major apology. And they had to change their story. The woman said, I don't remember that. Okay, Blake? And they still want him to be impeached. And I just put out a statement, and he's a great man, by the way, great talent, a great, brilliant man, Brett Kavanaugh. And I just put out a statement on social media that said, I don't think they'll do it, but they should, for the good of the nation. I call for the resignation of everybody at the New York Times involved in the Kavanaugh smear story.
And the president went on and had a few more words for the gray lady.
They've taken The old gray lady, do you know the New York Times for years? The old gray lady, so prestigious. They've taken the old great lady and broken her down, destroyed her virtue, and ruined her reputation. She can never recover and will never return to greatness under current management. The Times is dead. Long live the New York Times. Mm. Long live the New York Times.
And then did they have a moment of silence?
And they did not. They had a moment of celebration. Yeah. For more on this topic and a few others, we're pleased to be joined again by Rich Lowry, who is, of course, the editor of National Review, nationalreview.com, Fox News contributor, author of the upcoming book, The Case for Nationalism, How It Made Us Powerful, United, and Free. Oh, boy. That's going to get him on some lists. Rich, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. Richard, do we have you?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Okay, thank you. On the Kavanaugh story in the New York Times, you had the two reporters whose book launches today, the book that was the source of the excerpt that included that problematic deletion that needed an editor's note follow-up. And both Kate Kelly and Robin Pogrebin tell Larry O'Donnell, it was an editor's decision, and, you know, we think it was just sort of in the haste of putting together the excerpt for publication and removing the alleged victim's name that they accidentally also removed the portion of the story in which she doesn't recall the allegation. She doesn't recall what's alleged ever happening. Do you buy that?
I will say, being an editor, sometimes stuff happens that seems to make zero sense to the outside world, and the explanation, you know, makes no sense, but crazy things happen. So my attitude here is maybe the editors, they're inattentive, maybe they messed it up in the way they describe, but it's incumbent on the authors. They know this piece of information. They should know how important it is. You know, they're professional journalists, and if that the reference to her and her not recalling this incident was excised, authors push back against editors all the time. I mean, there's give and take all the time. And they should have said, hey, wait a minute. You know, you accidentally cut something that's really important. Let's get it back in. And they didn't do that. It took, 24 hours of pounding from the outside, led by my friend Molly Hemingway at The Federalist, who actually had a copy of the book, and said, hey, wait a minute. The book says that the alleged victim doesn't allege this took place. And this is just the Orwellian place we're in, where you have leading Democrats calling for him to be impeached, presuming his guilt for an offense that the alleged victim isn't accusing him of. How does that even work? Has that ever been the case in American history ever before that we've had such an instance?
But, I mean,
it just goes to the hatred they have for this guy.
It's basic journalism 101. If you're doing a story with an alleged victim who said there was no crime, then it's a dead story. And I just think that the American people, this is complete witch hunt and a smear job. And yeah, heads should roll over this, I think.
Well, the additional thing, though, too, Rich, is not just the unnamed alleged victim who doesn't recall the allegation, but Blasey Ford, who has now in the position, after all her allegations, hey, they're credible, may not have been Brett Kavanaugh, but we have to give her a lot of latitude here. The four individuals that she has named at the party, including Leland Kaiser, her good friend, now say there was no party. And Leland Kaiser says, I don't believe her story. So what do we have here?
Yeah, so Brett Kavanaugh, the allegation here is he engaged in this gross or at times monstrous, if the attack was what Blasey Ford described. That's a pretty terrible thing. But these weren't solitary events. They supposedly happened with groups of people involved. They happened at parties. And there's not one credible witness to any of it. And Blasey Ford, her story has changed about what year this happened, how old she was. She can't place the location. She can't place anyone who was at the party. She can't describe how she got home. Her story changed from when she initially told her therapist, and there are four people in the room, to her latest version. So she's just not credible. And Leland Kaiser was her friend. You know, I guess was a Democrat, right? I mean, she was at least married to Bob Beckel for a time.
Yeah.
And there was every incentive for her, every incentive to back up Blasey Ford's story. She'd be a hero now. She was getting pressured privately, we've learned from the Times, the book by these Times authors. And she didn't break because she can't remember such a party, and she just told the truth. So none of these allegations are credible. And what they've really tried to do is use one dubious, uncorroborated story to sort of create credibility for another dubious, uncorroborated story. So now they say, look, there are three allegations, but you look at each allegation and they're all nonsense. So that tells us more about them and their desperation to smear this guy than it does about Brett Kavanaugh's conduct. And what the president said last night, I think it has so much resonance for so many people because, you know, look, Donald Trump, he's done a lot of things, right, to get criticized for and to get slammed for.
Mm-hmm.
What's Brett Kavanaugh ever done? He's been this totally upstanding guy. He went out of his way to foster women's careers in the law to get them as his clerks, and they do this to him. So they can do that to him, they can do it to anyone.
And now, I just feel bad for, I mean, I know the woman, I mean, I feel bad for his kids and his wife because they have to relive this all over again. And it's not fair. They owe him an apology.
Right. I totally agree.
Well, now, to be fair, I mean, he was running with a bad crowd. Squee.
Squee.
Yeah.
I mean, forget that. No, what was the other guy's name?
And are
we going to have to get out the Brett Kavanaugh High School binder again?
We're going to get his dust calendar. I want to see the dust calendar again.
Who keeps their dust calendar from high school? But good for him. Thank God he kept it, honestly.
But that's the point, right? If it can happen to and I mean this in a congenial way, if it can happen to a dork like Brett Kavanaugh, it can happen to anybody. And that should put a real chill. And President Trump wasn't limiting it to politics when he was talking about the Democrats, because they don't limit it to politics or people in the political arena. This is anywhere in life now because everything has become politicized.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the agenda here with Kavanaugh, it's they're working the ref. And not just Kavanaugh, but I think John Roberts.
Yeah.
And they want the message to be, hey, look, guy, you overturn Roe, and what we're going to say to you, John Roberts, is that your court is illegitimate because 2 out of the 5 presumed votes were accused of sexual assault and are proven misogynists. So that they want Roberts, who's very sensitive about the legitimacy of the court, very sensitive about what the culture says, to believe that just will not be a legitimate decision. And he's got to wait another generation to get 2 more pro-life votes or whatever it is. You know, they'll still find a reason to call that illegitimate to just warn him off doing this. And I fear that might have some effect.
Well, especially, too, because the other implication, right, is, hey, we get to write the history, and we're going to make sure you go down with an asterisk, make sure you go down as some ignominious, backward Supreme Court justice. But it's so interesting, your point about the agenda. This is a little thing, but I think it's indicative of this larger point that you're making. One of the authors of this book that's released today, who was at Yale, Robin Pogerman, she allegedly tweeted over the weekend, having a penis thrust in your face at a drunken dorm party may seem like harmless fun, but when Brett Kavanaugh did it to her, Deborah Ramirez says it confirmed that she didn't belong at Yale in the first place. So, I mean, the author is sort of trivializing the allegation in a sense. It doesn't matter. It's about, you know, how Deborah Ramirez felt about it. She didn't belong at Yale. It gets into like socioeconomics in addition to this whatever is alleged. It's just such an interesting, flippant way to address what's supposed to be a deathly serious allegation.
Yeah, well, she didn't tweet that. The Times did.
No, I know, but they're attributing it to her.
And they delete it, because obviously really a stupid way to put it. But the piece that the excerpt from this book that had the new supposed allegation, as you point out, it was mainly about the socioeconomic contrast between Kavanaugh and Deborah Ramirez. And it's just piling all this nonsense on top of this alleged incident. And this is another reason why Kavanaugh is a hate figure, because he's a symbol of so-called white privilege. You know, this guy who, you know, drank some beers, as a lot of teenagers have done in American history, but then, you know, worked his butt off, right? And how many monsters do you know, out-of-control monsters that keep a desk calendar with extremely detailed notes of their whole life and keep that together, you know? So he did everything right. And he's still there's going to be an asterisk for all of liberal historians forevermore about him and his career on the court, and that's just a disgrace.
But don't you think this helps President Trump though in 2020? Because if anything, it's going to motivate the base.
Definitely, and this is where, you know, there was an article yesterday, I think in Axios, about how Pelosi's strategy to kind of widen out from Trump and to make McConnell and Kavanaugh and Trump the villains, not just Trump. And her insight is that it was too personal about Trump in 2016, which is probably right. But making it personal about Brett Kavanaugh, you know, how is that going to help? And again, you know, Trump, a lot of people hate and fear him. And not so much Brett Kavanaugh. And it really cost Democrats arguably in one or two Senate seats in 2018. And could have a similar effect this time around.
Some good news, bad news for the P-hats. The Women's March is going through a little bit of a shakeup. The leading anti-Semites associated with the P-hat marches, Linda Sarsour, Tamika Mallory, Bob Bland, they're all leaving. The good news is, though, they're backfilling with other anti-Semites, including Zahara Bilou, civil rights attorney, director of care in San Francisco, the San Francisco chapter, who has previously accused the FBI of being a recruitment arm of ISIS. So how's it going in terms of whipping up the base for the Democrats, regardless of who their nominee is? Because we're in a base plus environment. And if they have a nominee who can't bring the base, or the base can't bring the same level of energy that they have in sort of the first couple of years of the Trump administration, they have a political problem, don't they?
Yeah, and I mean, this goes to the presidential primary, you know, where Biden, he's sagging a little bit, you know, but still leading despite everything. But it's hard to see him lighting up the base. And the play for him is obviously for any swing voter just thinking, you know, he's relatively reasonable compared to the other Democrats. Then you have, you know, Warren and Sanders. And Sanders has associated himself with one of the most radioactive words in American politics, socialist. So I think it would be really hard for him. And Elizabeth Warren, you know, wisely avoided that word, but it's just about the half a dozen issues now where I think there would be a real problem for her making a case in a general election, which is why if I were a Democrat, I'd look beyond those three down into some of the current also-rans. Because I think Biden has real performance issues, and I think Warren and Sanders have real ideological and political issues in terms of their electability.
What about like a split the pot Andrew Yang, who's I'll get $1,000 a month, and that's going to usher in a new era of prosperity?
Yeah.
I applied on his website. I'm waiting to hear back.
Right. What are the 500?
Well, why not try?
It was smart. I mean, it was a great list building exercise that he did.
I saw somewhere yesterday, like 450,000 people ventured or something.
Yeah.
That's an enormous. You know, now he'll be a major figure for years now, just based on that.
So smart. And way to get people's email addresses like that.
No question. And he can reignite the debate over circumcision.
Yeah.
That this nation has spent
snippity snip,
a long overdue national conversation.
But I can't play that game, Dave.
The group of at present also rans. I mean, who has any potential? You would say maybe Kamala Harris, but she's been just such an awful candidate. It's hard to see how
terrible
she resuscitates herself.
She's been terrible. So don't laugh at me, because my colleagues do and scoff and say I'm ridiculous. And I know he's a phony and very annoying. Cory Booker, I think, has a little some up. See, there you go. That's the reaction I always get.
I was trying to be nice, but I can't.
He has I think, some upside potential. And, I mean, in theory, Amy Klobuchar. It's just that she's so dull.
Do you think in a fight between T-Bone and Corn Pop, who do you think would win?
I'm taking T-Bone.
Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, Fox News contributor, look for his forthcoming book. It's going to be available the first week in November. The Case for Nationalism, How It Made Us Powerful, United, and Free. Rich, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, guys.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and he made a splash, got a lot of notoriety a few years back when he wrote a piece in The Atlantic called Why I Hope to Die at 75. And part of the reason it got so much attention is because Dr. Zeke Emanuel is part of a powerful political and entertainment family, as you know. He's also a respected physician. He was an advisor to President Obama. And people.
His brother is a former mayor of Chicago, in case people didn't know.
I've heard that. Yeah. And so people were interested in what exactly, where's he coming from? Is this a pro-euthanasia thing? Is this, you know, he's revisited that column recently. So we wanted him to talk about that. Also, he wrote a rather interesting op-ed that I was a little disturbed by because I was agreeing with a lot of it. And so that concerned me. I had to see a doctor, ironically. Dr. Zeke Emanuel with Victor Fuchs, who's an econ professor at Stanford, wrote this piece about Medicare for All and the things that we should know when we're debating and thinking about health care and health insurance in America into the 2020 election. So we want to talk about all of that. Let's get right to it. Dr. Zeke Emanuel is an oncologist, a bioethicist, and vice provost at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of 10 books, including Brothers Emanuel and Reinventing American Healthcare. Brothers Emanuel, is that like a... Is that a like Brothers Karamazov, Dostoevsky takeoff? Is that about like free will and morality and the existence of God, I wonder? Well, let's ask him. Dr. Emanuel, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Nice to be here. I always like to talk to the other side.
Yes.
And we're glad to have you.
Just as an aside, that Brothers Emanuel, is it a Brothers Karamazov? Is that what you were thinking?
Well, let me say, one of the things you obviously didn't tell your listeners, but I will tell them, is authors do not pick their titles in general, neither in magazine articles. So Why I Hope to Die at 75 was not my title. It wasn't what I said in that article. And similarly with books, it's generally the publisher who wants to sell books developed those titles. I just write what's in between the title and the end little marking, whatever it is.
Well, what did you want the title of the book to be?
My Tribute to Dostoevsky?
Why I Love My Brothers.
Oh, okay.
All right.
So it's not exactly Dostoevsky. Now let's revisit the other other op-ed that you penned. I mentioned that was titled by somebody else.
Yes.
Why I Hope to Die at 75. Now you're revisiting it, and why the revisitation? What's the point that you're...
No, I actually did revisit it. The MIT Technology Review, which is a very prestigious, was running a whole series of articles about scientists pushing back the frontiers and making people live longer and longer and longer. And they thought they needed something to balance the sort of techno-utopianism that isn't this great. And I seem to be the victim of every time someone wants a reasoned answer why living forever is not a good idea, they seem to call me.
Well. So just to refresh the recollection then of our listeners, what is the argument that you are making in that piece?
Well, there are many arguments, but I'll put it this way. If you ask most people, they say, no, I don't want quantity of life. It's not about how long I live. It's about the quality of life. And then when you look at the behavior, people say, it's like, oh, let me live longer and longer and longer. And they have, I think many people have this perception that, oh, I'm going to live longer. I'm going to live, you know, instead of 80 years old, I will live to 100 years old. And by the way, those extra two decades, that 20 years, I'm going to get that when I'm 30, and I'm going to be vim and vigorous. That's just not the way it works. you get those extra two decades at the end. And so I ask, you know, what is the purpose of a life? What's a meaningful life? What are you happy about at the end of a life? How do we think about that? And if you think about it, there are sort of three things that go into it. Meaningful work. It turns out that people, you know, most of us want to get meaning out of the work we're doing and want to think we're adding to the world. There's meaningful relationships. How do we interact with people? And then there's a sort of fun and avocational interests and our religious experience. And for me, I like to cook. I like to go bicycle riding. I do like to travel. I like to have dinner parties with friends and talk to them. So you get those three things. Well, one of the important things to notice, at least two of them, meaningful work and meaningful relationships, require certain cognitive abilities and being with it, as we put it colloquially. And it turns out that if you look at mental functioning, it declines pretty rapidly with aging. There are some mental functions that stay up. You know, your vocabulary, actually, something you use all the time. That actually, you've got what's called crystallized knowledge. That stays. But almost everything else, your working knowledge, your ability to problem solve, your ability to see a new circumstance and interpret it, your reaction times, your ability to newly name things that you haven't, to associate things, all of those go down with aging. And we know if you look, you know, meaningful work actually goes down. There was a recent article in the MIT by an MIT professor that actually when senior scientists who are very prestigious die, the field undergoes an enormous blossoming of productivity and creativity and new ideas come rushing in, which is what you expect. A lot of, you know, new ideas are from younger people, not from older people who keep pounding away at their old ideas.
So I don't want to go too sci-fi on you, but I mean, this is like a real topic area led by some leading lights like futurists in Silicon Valley. So this whole idea of, you know, preserving your brain and, I mean, I'm going to be sort of general here, preserving your brain and like putting on some robot body and living in Westworld, that's silly to you?
Yes. Yeah. For one thing, you know, I mean, I do think this idea of I need to live forever, and by the way, I'm going to invest in trying to live forever, that is centered in California. And I think there is a kind of extreme hubris. What would the world be without me and my brain and my contribution?
Yeah, I agree with you.
It'll continue perfectly fine without you and your brain and contribution. And by the way, again, as you get older, you know, we see this all the time with our relatives and with other people. Your ideas become ossified. Mm-hmm. You have the same reaction. You have the same thought patterns. And it's not new thinking. It's not meaningful thinking. It's not creative. And a world populated by people who are thinking the same old thought is not necessarily going to be a world that's progressing and generating new insights.
So, Dr. Emmanuel, when you do turn 75, I know you're a long ways from that, are you still going to stop taking antibiotics and getting vaccinations and refusing medical interventions?
So,
or have you changed your mind? It's okay.
No, I haven't changed my mind. And I think the important thing for your listeners, while it says, well, I hope to die at 75, I am and have been for 25 years against euthanasia and assisted suicide and the legalization. I do not think those are, and here I'm going against the trend in the country. I think those are mostly acts of desperation. What I said in the article, it's not that I'm going to refuse all medical care. I am going to take medical care that relieves pain. I'm going to take, you know, you know, if I broke my hip, I would get my hip replaced. What I am not going to do is get medical treatment where the purpose of the medical treatment is merely to keep me alive. That just doesn't seem the purpose
All right, your opposition to euthanasia. We're agreeing on too many things. All right, so let's let's get to your New York Times op-ed here.
You might become a progressive liberal.
I'm too old and ossified to do that.
We see this in many people.
Yes. The piece in the New York Times. You go through four things people should know about health care. And let's start with Medicare for All, because your brother, Rahm, now this is a political assessment, but this factors in. This is a political process to enact legislation. He basically said, look, the position of removing private health insurance from 175 million people and providing free health insurance for people in this country illegally is an untenable position in the general election. That's what Rahm said. You suggest that one of the fallacies that you address in this piece is that Medicare for All is unaffordable, which is one of the criticisms of it. You say it's not.
Yes. So, ironically, Rahm and I actually agree on the politics, which is I don't think it's Medicare for All. You know, if you look at the history of healthcare reform, it's not a tenable policy for the American public. And I do think that there is a good motivation why people want Medicare for All. They want security. They want to know that if, God forbid, something happens, they lose their job and their health insurance, or they get some catastrophic illness, they can get good treatment and they can afford it. And I think in the current uncertain system created with a lot more uncertainty and coverage going down by the Republicans, people are nervous, and I think Medicare for All looks like a good safety net and a solid safety net. One of the criticism made by many people, Michael Bloomberg is one, Joe Biden made it, is that it's unaffordable. Well, the fact is it will change who's paying for health care. It'll be, you know, there's a lot of stuff that people are paying for their private insurance, and that would shift to the federal government. But the total amount being paid is certainly not going to go up. And that's an evaluation by a very conservative group at George Mason University. So we need to distinguish between how much we're paying, which is the affordability question, and who's paying, which is the question of whether it's the federal government or the private sector. And that's a big difference. On the who's paying, there's no doubt it's going to move over to the federal government under Medicare for All. Under the how much we're paying, it'll be roughly the same as to what we're paying today. Depending on how much you pay doctors and hospitals, it might be a little more, a little bit less. But it's not going to break the bank. It's not going to put us to 25% of GDP from the current 18%. And so that's not a good argument against Medicare for All. I think there are both political arguments. I think there might be policy arguments against it. But the unaffordability is a canard, as we academics say. Not a valid argument.
But the Mercatus Center study does not include what all the Democrats on the debate stage said they support, which is free health care for people in this country illegally. So that's another, let's say, 12 to 20 million people. That certainly changes the calculus.
It's not 20 million. It's not 20 million people.
Well, whatever,
when we were in the
is.
White House.
12 million.
We were in the White
10
House.
Million.
Well, wait a second. When we were in the White House, we looked at this. It's about 11 million.
Okay, 11 million. Does that change the calculus?
Wait a second. It changes the calculus ever so slightly, and I'll tell you why. Most of those people, it turns out, they're working. They're paying taxes. They're actually, you know, they're in this country for a reason. We need them as farm workers, as workers in slaughterhouses, as construction workers. They're actually in the country. Second of all, the only consideration for covering them that had ever been considered, certainly when I was in the policy circles, was they could buy into, like, the exchanges, or they could buy in and pay a premium.
Yeah, but that's not what's being proposed now. That's not what's being proposed now.
If you do that, right, it's like, okay, you know, some French person comes over and decides they're going to shop on Michigan Avenue. All right, they can pay full price. That's fine for us. And I think... you know, again, I think it's probably politically untenable that we're going to get insurance for illegal immigrants. We need to solve the immigration problem and the fact that we need these people, we employ these people, and we all benefit from having them in terms of our fruits and vegetables, our construction. We need to figure out an immigration solution.
Agreed.
No doubt part of that solution is going to be, it's going to end up covering them.
But that said, you know, what you know about health care, what Democratic candidate are you supporting or who has the best health care plan?
I support the Democratic candidate that is called ABT, anybody but Trump. Every single candidate up there on the stage would be a better president than Donald Trump. And that's the candidate I'm supporting.
I would say one other thing. Sure.
I would work with any Democratic candidate to improve the American healthcare system because I think all of them have proposals. You know, when I went into the Obama administration, I didn't agree with the general approach. But the goal is let's improve the system. Let's make it more accessible so people actually aren't facing these huge deductibles. Make it bring the cost down, make the quality consistently better. There are lots of things we can do to that end. And I would be happy to work with anyone who is serious about that.
Do you agree that if you want to change any system, you change the way money flows and who gets to make spending decisions? Do you agree with that idea?
I think actually, yes. I think incentives are very important, and right now the system is rife with perverse incentives.
So how would the government controlling the flow of money and the spending decisions change the system for 175 million people with private health insurance under Medicare for All?
Well, I mean, they first of all, they would cover things. Second of all, the co-pays and deductible ratio, at least under Senator Sanders' proposal, would bring the deductibles down and the co-pays down compared to the high deductible plan. He wants to actually bring them to zero. That may or may not be a good idea. Most of us think, who are in policy, think some deductibles and some co-pays for some things are very useful.
What about choice
and
quality?
There are lots of countries that want to emphasize people should go to primary care doctors, so they make the co-pay and deductible for primary care doctors zero, but the copay for specialists higher. They want to emphasize people like diabetics should take their insulin or take their oral medication to reduce their blood pressure. People with asthma should take their inhalers. So you bring their copay and deductibles down to zero. There are lots of modifications like that that could be done to make it more affordable for people and change how we approach care in this country to make it more advantageous.
What about the metrics of choice and quality as it pertains to changing the money flow and the spend decisions, as I suggested?
Well, there's no doubt that the way we pay now, we just pay a fee-for-service largely, not exclusively, but largely, and that doesn't vary by the quality of care very much. And if you want to get doctors and the rest of the medical system to really focus on quality, you need to adjust how much you pay based on quality. So we've actually made a suggestion, last week, 2 weeks ago in JAMA, that what we should do is, for example, on surgeries, we could actually get in real time the data on surgeries. So how long did the surgery take so we could pay accurately on length of time? And second of all, you can see what the complications are from the surgery in the hospital. Did the patient get an infection? Did the patient end up in the intensive care unit? And you could adjust that patient, adjust that payment you're making to the surgeon and the hospital on the quality of care. And I think those kind of adjustments would be very important to incentivize people to pay attention and reduce their complications and improve the quality of care. And I think you're seeing a lot of experiments about doing that in this country, and we need more experiments, and we need to push harder on it. And I've been a big advocate of that since passage of the Affordable Care Act. There are some provisions in there that I helped author to try to push our system to pay doctors and hospitals with incentives to actually do a better job in terms of improving the quality and reducing the cost.
Well, we're going to have you back because I want to get to the other fallacies that you tackled in your piece as well. But Dr. Zeke Emanuel, oncologist, bioethicist, vice provost at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Emanuel, appreciate you joining us again.
A pleasure to join you and to make sure that you're going to see the light of my positions on healthcare.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Emanuel.
You're the best. Appreciate it. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
They got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy on a special campus beat. We have George Mason University econ professor Walter Williams coming up. And I can't say this to him directly. I have to cover the story without him. I'd be too embarrassed.
I don't know if I want to hear about it because I just listened to that tease.
The Consent Carnival at George Mason University took place last week.
The Consent Carnival?
Consent Carnival featured a penis ring toss, vagina beanbag toss, and lubricant taste test.
See, that's so gross. The taste testing part is really what hits at home.
The vagina beanbag toss, though.
Is that like cornhole?
Hello.
Well, that's
giant inflatable lips that serve it to mimic a vagina. All students can throw large pink beanbags into it.
Okay. All right. Clearly, it's not cornhole.
The game doubled as an educational display, informing students on flyers that not all people with vaginas are women. From the flyer. Genitalia is not an indicator of gender. It can be harmful to assume so. It can also be surprising to assume not.
Who won the vagina beanbag contest?
I don't have the...
have the top 10 finishers? What kind of a hack are you?
Mm-hmm.
Together, prof.
For the penis ring toss,
okay. Oh,
I know you
that?
Were interested. Yeah. The educational component to that game was that the 8 or so 3-foot-high penis inflatables were surrounded by signs on how to correctly use a condom, among other information.
Put a hood on it. All right. Okay.
Huh. Oh
my gosh, you're making my eye twitch.
In a related story with the whole gender fluidity construct, you know, gender is a social construct, mm-hmm. I regret to inform you that your adopted state of Iowa, since you're a University of Iowa grad, has been banned by California.
Oh, I heard.
California has added
following their... their ideas and norms.
It's funny, the travel ban list. Boy, I know the left is very opposed to travel bans in certain contexts, but California put Iowa on the list of states on its travel ban because of the state's prohibition against public funding of gender transition surgeries under Medicaid.
That tourism pipeline from California to Iowa, it was really big back in the day.
Well, but it's all for like sports teams and stuff to travel. The California blacklist, California is going to be locked in. You're going to have to build a wall to keep people in, East Germany style, and I'm sure Gavin Newsom would be open to that. The blacklist includes Alabama, Kentucky, North Carolina, Texas, Oklahoma, Mississippi, and now Iowa.
Where are they going to play any? They're in the Pac-12.
They'll just come here to beat up on Illinois, I guess. For more on state of play on campus, Professor Williams has written about this as not what we talked about, but some other more important topics on the academic side. We're pleased to be joined by his economics eminence, Walter Williams, professor of economics at George Mason University and syndicated columnist. Professor, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, and thanks for inviting me.
Would you like to comment on the consent carnival at George Mason?
I do not. This is the first time I've heard of it.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
You were not a participant in any of those games then. Yeah, not surprising. All right. I want to get to your piece, which is about literally giving out A's for effort when it comes to skills like writing cogent papers.
That's right. The American University hired a professor from Inouye, I think, from the University of Washington, and this professor is going to teach the other professors at American University that judging a person's writing abilities is kind of racist, and that that students should not be graded on their writing ability, but the effort that they put into a project.
Well, how do you go about determining that? I mean, is it the time that you spent in the construction of the paper?
For the life of me, I don't know. I should have attended the lecture to find out. However, I think that what he's talking about is forgiving and ignoring the writing ability of mostly black students, but he's going to hold white students speaking and writing, he's going to hold them to King's English, and the King's English is defined as standard or a pure or correct English grammar.
I wish I could have got an A for effort in my econometrics class at Northwestern, but I digress. So it's one thing to kill the English language with respect to allowing these students to graduate with phony baloney English degrees. It's another thing when it comes to medicine. And this op-ed in the Wall Street Journal by Dr. Stanley Goldfarb, who is a former associate dean at University of Pennsylvania's law school, medical school, excuse me, talks about the piece is called Take Two Aspirin and Call Me by My Pronouns. He talks about how social justice and the politicization of higher education that has infected the undergraduate schools is now affecting the professional graduate schools like medicine. And he writes, the prospect of this new politicized medical education should worry all Americans, because you're spending time not training doctors to be practitioners of responsible medicine. You're spending at least some time training them to be social justice warriors.
That's right. And what it's going to do is going to encourage people to only go to doctors who are over 40 or 50 years old.
Right.
But I think, you know, some of this stuff is just really, just really preposterous, saying that, you know, that women aren't the only people that can have vaginas and all that kind of stuff. And myself, see, I'm old fashioned. I'm in my 84th year of life. I go by the DNA, or people's
XXXY.
Chromosomes.
Yeah, right.
So if you're XY, you're male, and if you're XX, you're female. So.
Yeah,
I understand that's very narrow.
That's an antiquated way of thinking, Professor. You got to embrace the brave new world. Talk about what's happening on college campus, though, in terms of the quality of students. Now, in the economics discipline, which you have spent so many years as an educator, what have you seen in terms of the state of students? I always use this reference from Condi Rice, who talked about at Stanford, which she teaches at Stanford now. At Stanford, the biggest problem she has with her students is that none of them can write, going back to our previous conversation. But none of them can write, which means they're not thinking clearly. They can't think cogently. They can't write clearly. And so it's very difficult for them to offer much in the way of contextual dissertations on history or persuasive writing or anything of the sort. And that's a big problem. What about in the economics discipline?
You're absolutely right. Now, our economics department, we have a worldwide reputation for being a free market, libertarian-type economics department. And we can boast of having had two Nobel laureates in economics on our faculty. And the students who... one of my jobs is to... I teach the incoming PhD students their first course in microeconomic theory. And these are students who self-select to come to George Mason University. And I've had no trouble with their writing, except sometimes there's something called their legibility that's required. And so, as a matter of fact, I tell the students that if I have to decipher an answer, I'm just going to assume that it's wrong.
What's the two Nobel laureates, James Buchanan, who was the other one?
Vernon Smith.
Oh,
and Vernon Smith, I'm very proud to say I hired him when I was the chairman of the economics department, and he was here for a year, and he won the Nobel Prize.
Now, you wrote in your article about the ethnic studies model curriculum, and just elaborate on that, please.
In California, they proposed a program, an ethnic studies program, and the curriculum includes gross anti-Israel bias, and it teaches students that capitalism is racist and sexist. That's what they wanted to teach students. But however, fortunately, the California Department of Education took the proposal down off their website because they got a lot of blowback as a result of it.
I wanted to get your reaction to the 1619 project that has been developed by the New York Times, that's already insinuating its way into K-12 curricula. What you think about sort of extending, expanding, and sort of recasting the history of America?
Well, I think that if there's going to be a teaching of the history of America, we should get it quite right. And this New York Times writer, Nicole Hannah Jones, she's a staff writer for New York Magazine, and she said, and her article is called America Wasn't a Democracy Until Black Americans Made It One. And I start out my column is that the founders had utter contempt for the idea of democracy. You don't find the word democracy in either of our two most founding documents, both the Declaration of Independence and our United States Constitution. And the founders envisioned a anti-majority rule kind of government. And if you look at the Constitution, it is very anti-majority rule. That is, it takes two-thirds of houses of the Congress to propose an amendment to the Constitution. It takes three-quarters of the states to ratify it. It takes two-thirds of both houses to overturn a presidential veto, and there are other many, many other measures. But to show that it's not a democracy, it's just a very easy way to do it, is to ask the question, when we pledge allegiance to the flag, is it for the democracy for which it stands or the republic?
Yeah.
Or we ask the question about the Civil War song, was it the battle hymn of the democracy or the battle hymn of the republic? And I think that a fundamental misunderstanding about the history of our country is not to recognize that we are supposed to be a republic.
He is Professor Walter Williams, professor of economics at George Mason University. Get all of his writings at his blog, walterewilliams.com, including his most recent one on that writing professor at American University we were discussing. Professor Williams, always an honor. Thanks for joining us.
And thank you. Bye.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, Sean Spicer doing a tango,
oh.
Sean Spicer in pastels. Those two things should never happen.
Honey, it was neon green. And it was god-awful. But, I mean, not god-awful. I didn't think his dance was that bad. But that outfit, I mean, if they dress you up to look like Cha-Cha, that's when you put your foot down and you say, can I have something a little more masculine? But mm-hmm. It was you didn't like the way he did the dance, huh?
I'm no expert.
Well no, you although, actually, you are.
I mean, I was.
Runner up.
No.
Well, second, yeah.
I got second place. I lost to Courtney Hall Dancing with the Chicago Stars. But I mean, in terms of who won the audience, and very much like Gladiator, whoever wins the crowd wins their freedom. I won my freedom.
Oh, you got fan favorite and the Congeniality Award, I heard.
And top fundraiser.
Yeah, it's good to bring in the bucks.
That's right.
But what did the judges say, Dan?
What were you doing there? You were supposed to be attacked by a swarm of wasps. I have no idea, but I actually have to say there was some elements of salsa there, not always on time or on rhythm. And, you know, and your hip action, at times, it looked like they were set in cement, your hips. You have to get them going a little bit more. But I have to say it was strangely entertaining.
All right.
I'll take that.
What did he give them?
That's the only way that spicy can be entertaining, is strangely. Another judge's review.
I was very surprised and happily surprised with the way you came at it. Just, you're very boisterous, and I really appreciate that. It's great for the dance. You were offbeat most of the dance. but you had fun.
And yeah, I did. I did have fun.
All right, let's.
Well, I admire your courage coming on this show, and as the others have said, you brought fun to the ballroom. Nice. Well done.
Yeah, he got the courage and
courage. They're paying him each $125,000 base salary just to dance.
$125,000 for the appearance to get a 12 and embarrass yourself like that. It's not worth it. By the way, though, good one for Spicy. Not the lowest score ever.
Good.
That's Lamar Odom with an 11. He got a 12.
Oh, good.
Out of 30.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
top of the morning, updating one of our top stories. This is the abortionist, recently deceased Klopfer in Will County. The more than 2,200 fetal remains that were found in his home. And Amy, you talked to his wife's, his widow's attorney, and have some new information for
us.
Yeah,
I just got off the phone with attorney Kevin Bolger, who describes a pretty horrifying sight. He said that the two daughters were cleaning out the house. They said that their late father was a hoarder, and they opened up a cardboard box, and in it was a hermetically sealed bag, and inside the bag were fetuses. And these cardboard boxes were all over the house. Some were, most of them were in the garage, but some, then he had another garage that he used to store these fetuses. But this is very important. On most bags, the name of the mother was on the bag and the date that the abortion was performed, some dating back as far as 20 years. And I asked, why did he do it? Was it a cost-saving measure? And he said, we have no idea. But the fact, but he was a hoarder, and so was Gus Snell. He was a hoarder as well, and it would have, you know, piles of debris and garbage stacked up to the ceiling. But a lot of them were these cardboard boxes, again, with hermetically sealed fetuses inside, to the tune of 2,246. And he got word this morning that the Indiana coroner wants some of these bodies or fetuses returned to Indiana.
And
the crime scene has been fully processed.
Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb and members of the Republican delegation, congressional delegation from Indiana, have called for a federal investigation into this discovery, this gruesome discovery. In addition, you've had the bishop of the Joliet Diocese, one of the bishops, Bishop Conlon from the Joliet Diocese, offer to work with government as well as other compassionate social service agencies to provide a proper burial for all of these dead children.
And in one, Serena Dykeson, she's a former patient, had a late-term abortion with the doctor. She wants her baby back, and she's now a pro-lifer.
That shock turned into lying in bed sobbing at the thought of my baby being on his property. If he could have the babies all these years later, I have a right to know if she was one of them.
We'll begin there with Michelle Malkin, senior editor at Conservative Review, host of Michelle Malkin Investigates. Of course, she's going to be at our Freedom Jamboree coming up in a few weeks. Freedom Fest, sure. She's got a new book, Open Borders, Inc., Who's Funding America's Destruction, that released last week. Michelle, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So Who's Funding America's Destruction? I know this is not all-encompassing, but it seems like we are, in part, when it comes to forced funding of Planned Parenthood in the wake of what we may have here with a Midwestern version of Gosnell.
Yeah, no question about it. Taxpayers have been forced to fund the most fundamental destruction, the destruction of human life for years and years and years. We have President Trump, who has taken steps now that have induced Planned Parenthood to refuse at least some of those federal funds. But the fact is that you have state health agencies and state regulators across the country, whether it's Chicago or in Philadelphia, where I am right now and covered the Gosnell horror for years and years before it broke out into the national news, who were silent co-conspirators. And that's the problem here, is that when you've got the death lobby and the death industry subsidized by taxpayers working with regulators who looked the other way for decades, this is the logical outcome of that. And if people are deluded into thinking that this is the exception rather than the rule, one of the things that should have been learned after Gosnell is that there were many so-called doctors like this, Dr. Deaths, who've been operating undercover, and I fear for what we may discover on down the line like this.
Well, when you hear about this story outside of Chicago and Crete, Illinois, I mean, it sounds exactly like what Dr. Gosnell did, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And why should we be shocked that doctors who are supposed to abide by the Hippocratic Oath of doing no harm and then turn around murder innocent unborn lives end up being ghouls like this who, you know, in the case of Gosnell, had trophies, trophy cases of unborn babies' feet. Again, I mean, I think the question is how many other Dr. Gosnells and ones like this. I covered Andrew Rutland in Southern California and another doctor, Stephen Bingham in Maryland, who were immediately investigated after the Gosnell case broke out into the public, and then it just sort of seems to disappear.
In part, we're funding America's destruction, too, by the companies we patronize, aren't we? I'm going referencing your book, Open Borders, Inc., who's funding America's destruction. Corporate America.
Yes, yes. If we're going to segue to immigration and open borders, I think it is an eye-opener in the book that many of these corporations, which ironically enough are being picketed by the social justice warrior groups funded by George Soros, are themselves filled with open borders ideologues. And you have Microsoft, which was picketed by some of these groups in Manhattan, which internally has thousands of employees demanding that their supervisors cut off any kind of IT contracts working with the Department of Homeland Security and Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So the demonization of ICE, the Abolish ICE movement, is coming from within corporate America and outside it with these agitators who are now inciting violence across the country against ICE.
It was a remarkable statement that Ilhan Omar made over the, well, video that surfaced that she had made more than a month ago, but she was asked about it on Face the Nation this weekend. It's it was after her visit to Ghana, along with Nancy Pelosi, where they visited apparently dungeons where the slave trade took place 400 years ago. And she compared the dungeons in Ghana used in the slave trade 400 years ago to the situation at the border with our family separation policy. Of course, she meant no offense to customs and border patrol agents. She was just making a comparison that they're doing the same things that slave traders did 400 years ago in Africa.
Yeah, no offense intended, I'm sure.
Right.
There are several chapters in the book that deal with the true causes of these illegal alien caravans that are laying siege to our southern border and who's truly responsible for inducing these illegal alien parents to pay coyotes to bring children and drag them across the desert with complete strangers, many of whom are abusing these children along the way, or dragooning young girls and teenagers into human trafficking rings. It is the pull factors, the magnets that are supported by the people who pose as the most compassionate people on the planet, when they're the ones that are imposing such misery, not only on the people who are participating in these global smuggling rings, but also all of the rest of us who have to bear the consequences of uncontrolled immigration anarchy. And unfortunately, that includes many religious nonprofits that enjoy a great reputation as the world's saviors of the poor and oppressed. And particularly in the Chicago area, I know you have many informed listeners who are quite aware of the radicalization of the Catholic Church by Saul Alinsky, the Industrial Areas Foundation. I connect all the dots. With money there, basically the social justice organizing arm of the Catholic Church, which has helped stand up an entire illegal alien shelter network, which again incentivizes people to do incredibly dangerous things when they could be staying in their home countries and holding their own governments accountable, I don't know, for spending and wasting away all of the billions of dollars of foreign aid that we pour into them.
And it's not just Central Americans. I mean, there's a large contingency of Haitians who even got into a physical altercation with Mexican military on their southern border, and people from Africa and India, too.
Well, I've been reporting on that exact phenomenon since the September 11th terror attacks, because the entire world knows that if you can manufacture a fake story of asylum or manufacture a fake family, that once you touch foot on American soil, immediately surrender at a border patrol sector, and you will be caught and released. And fortunately, we have the Trump administration, better late than never, finally addressing that revolving door and trying to shut off those magnets. But The other problem, too, is that it's not just the southern border. I've been covering problems on the northern border since 2002. And the book talks about the refugee resettlement racket, where people are waltzing in through the front door. And many of these religious organizations that have lucrative government contracts to the tune of billions of dollars over the last 20, 25 years are cooperating with the United Nations, many transnational organizations that explicitly are trying to undermine American sovereignty.
Part of the other infrastructure with respect to funding the left, and I use that as a proxy for funding America's destruction, is nonprofits. There was a piece, I think it was in the Journal, I'm going by memory, though, recently, looking at, I think it was just a couple of years ago, maybe calendar year 2017, and the distribution of funds from foundations to policy advocacy groups. It was something like $7 billion to left policy groups, C4s, some C3s, as compared to something like $2 billion to center-right conservative or center-right policy advocacy groups. And that that disparity in funding, that's substantial in terms of what floods the media airwaves from organizations that are set up to do just that.
Yes, there are very important chapters in the book, and I identify in within 500 pages more than 400 plus individual organizations, tax-exempt nonprofits that spread the money. I mean, it's both private philanthropy and government funding. Open Society Foundations, obviously, is the big kahuna run by George Soros. He's earmarking $18 billion out of his $25.2 billion net worth to help these groups proliferate. And they're in every backyard in America. If you wonder why it is that the rent-a-mob is able to organize on a dime, it's because of that money, which is leveraged. Because as I say, hundreds of those organizations are tax-exempt, nonprofit. Then they spread the grants that they get from George Soros to, it's like, you remember that Fabergé shampoo commercial? I'll tell two friends, you tell two friends.
So on and so on and so on.
It's like that. And so on and so on and so on. I think, you know, for individual Americans who feel like this is a completely insurmountable problem, I do recommend that people start small in their own ability to defund Open Borders, Inc. If you realize, for example, that the George Clooney and the Clooney Foundation are working with the Tides Foundation and the Young Center there at the University of Chicago Law School to provide free pro bono legal representation to illegal aliens to bring their cases up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Stop giving them money. Stop supporting Hollywood. Stop supporting the Open Borders media propagandists. And then hold your own elected officials accountable for not realizing that we should every day be questioning what these organizations are doing. Why don't we have IRS investigations of this? Why did we stop at Acorn?
And what about big tech? And I mean, especially the concerning testimony from several weeks back when Dennis Prager was before a Senate subcommittee and psychiatrist Dr. Bob Epstein talked about, per his research in Google over the last 6 years, what he estimates the number of votes they moved in 2016 and the number of votes they could move in 2020.
Yeah, and so again, I think that people should start small and start weaning themselves off of Google. Don't use a Chrome browser. Use DuckDuckGo as your search engine and look for alternatives like Proton Mail. And really educate yourself about how deeply embedded big tech is with the speech police created by George Soros. There's an entire chapter on the history of the Southern Poverty Law Center, all the way up to its current role that it enjoys inside the corporate offices of Google and Facebook to help them identify enemies and have Silicon Valley cook up algorithms and artificial intelligence that is helping to deplatform some of the most effective voices in alternative media. I mean, I've been very blessed over the last 20 years to be able to spread my message on social media and plant my flag in that space and create two successful social media businesses. No longer. I've seen my friends be kicked off, not left and right, but right and right and alt-right, I suppose. I don't know what you call it. People who support the sovereignty of this country deemed enemies that have to be wiped off the entire face of the Internet. that's alarming, and that's what fueled me to get this book out there and talk about it like I am with you all.
She is Michelle Malkin. She's a senior editor of Conservative Review, host of Michelle Malkin Investigates. The book we've been discussing, you get the top lines, and I'll get the book so you get the details. Open Borders, Inc., Who's Funding America's Destruction? And Michelle is going to be with us on November 2nd at our Freedom Fest
Summit.
Jamboree
Don't
Fair.
No.
Consent Carnival, whatever we're calling
Freedom
it.
It's Freedom Summit, and if you want tickets, go to 560theanswer.com and click on the Freedom Summit banner.
Michelle Malkin, thanks so much for joining us. Look forward to seeing you in November.
Thank you. See you soon.
Take care.
And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, I remember that time I asked Triumph, the insult comedy dog, what do you use an Illinois state legislator's head for? And he said,
for me to poop on.
That's right. That is what you use it for. And another member of the animal kingdom has taken Triumph's advice.
Yes. Democratic state rep Jaime Andrade. Did I butcher his name?
Jaime Andrade.
Oh,
I'm surprised you with the silly accents when you Hispanic name.
Well, because some people I know were Jaime, and now they're Jaime.
Well, yeah.
Jaime Andrade. He was discussing the problem about pigeon pooping, because the Irving Park station there, it's called the pigeon poop station, really. And while he was talking to a reporter, there it went.
Thanks for the sound effect,
do you
Michael
like that?
Winslow.
Thank
yeah,
you.
That's
it,
great.
It dropped the deuce right on his head.
Yeah. That pigeon...
is now a hero.
A pigeon dropped a deuce on Jaime Andrade's head for all of us, and I appreciate it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Tickets for Freedom Summit Chicago are on sale now at freedomsummitchicago.com. That's freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and I read about the book by this next guest over at Tyler Cohen's blog, Marginal Revolution. It's interesting how college makes or breaks us, the years that matter most, how college makes or breaks us, a new book by Paul Tough, who's a contributing writer for New York Times Magazine, and he's actually in town this week, so this is fortuitous. Tonight he's going to be at the Latin School in the Wrigley Theater there, 7 to 8:30. And tomorrow night he's going to be at Harold Washington Library with Alex Kotlowitz. We've had Alex on the show before. He wrote, he wrote There Are No Children Here 25 years ago, but he wrote a book last year called American Summer about violence in Chicago. It's a good read. Interesting. We had a good conversation with him. So this one paragraph that Cohen excerpted is interesting. How college makes or breaks us. At the University of Virginia, only 13% of undergrads are eligible for Pell Grants, a lower rate than at Princeton or Trinity College. At the University of Michigan, the figure is 16%. At the University of Alabama, the flagship public institution of one of the poorest states in the nation, the median family income for undergrads is higher than at Bryn Mawr, which is, if you don't know, a very expensive, small, elite liberal arts school. I'm not that surprised about Alabama because of the heavy recruiting they're doing around the country, leveraging the football program in part. But it is interesting, and what it says about the reality or the lack thereof of the watchword on campus, diversity, right? Mm-hmm. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Paul Tough. Paul, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
The impetus for this book, you try to answer some sort of tough questions that are abstract in a sense, like does college work? I suppose it does for some, and it doesn't for others. I would respond to whether or not, after your research, you believe this statement that it doesn't matter so much where you go to college; it's how you go to college.
I think it's a little of both. There is some striking data that economists have uncovered, especially in the last 5 years or so, that show that going to a more selective college really does pay off in future earnings. Now, for any individual student, does that mean you need to do what a lot of affluent kids have done and look for the most selective college that will admit you? Not necessarily. You're absolutely right that the there are lots of different choices for any one individual. But the fact that the system as a whole has become so unbalanced, where there are certain schools that are so dominated by affluent students and yet tend to increase their earnings the most, while there are other students who are going to much more less selective institutions, students with less money, with much lower graduation rates, it's led to a real stratification in the way higher education works these days.
So do you think it's simply a rigged game designed to protect the elites who have power and everything else?
I have my moments when I believe that. There are so many advantages in the system that high-income families get, starting with the SAT, including early decision, admissions, and simply the fact of tuition payments. One thing that really struck me in my reporting was, despite all of the talk that admissions officers tend to express about how important diversity is, how important merit is, really they are salespeople selling a product, and their income is tuition. So they've got to pay a lot of attention to who can pay and who can't.
Right. So this was the issue. There was an op-ed, I think it was in the Journal last week, calling for the abolition of legacy admissions, in part after the admissions scandals involving high-profile people. How much of a factor is legacy admissions at some of the elite schools?
It's big. It's not everything. There are a lot of other factors at play, but there's no question that legacy admissions, meaning the children of alumni, get an advantage in admissions, and that means that those are, especially at selective colleges, those are almost always young people who already have lots of advantages. So it's one more way that the playing field is tilted.
And with respect to that, different institutions tilt it differently too. So, for example, at U of I had, which was a land grant state school with a particular mission, has a very high percentage of foreign national students, particularly from China, north of 25% of the student body, that they're paying full freight. They're also looking at diversity, but diversity that's paying full freight.
Yeah, I mean, I think we put a lot of pressure on these institutions because we do, on the one hand, demand a certain amount of diversity and meritocracy from them. But we also, in many cases, especially with public institutions, don't give them as much money to function as we used to. Just over the past couple of decades, we've cut per student funding for public higher education by about 16% per student. And that's at a time when all of the signs in the economy and the labor market are that we need more and better educated young people. So when you do that to those institutions, they sort of scramble for ways to bring in money, and often they do they come up with strategies like the one you're describing at U of I, like what the University of Alabama is doing, educating rich kids from around the country instead of ambitious young people from Alabama. That means that they have to, in many ways, betray their real mission.
And I don't know if you heard what's going on also in Illinois, is that rich parents are giving up custody of their children to live with poor aunts or uncles or cousins in order to get a break on tuition.
I did hear that. That was a remarkable article, and I think it's just another way that when parents feel like this is already some kind of rigged game, even if they recognize that in a certain way it's rigged in their favor, they feel like there are no rules. It's just a zero-sum game, winner take all, do what you can to get ahead. That's not how we used to think about higher education, and I don't think it's how we should now.
And so tell me what the reaction would be from college admissions offices to this proposal. Let's do it like we do tryouts for the Chicago Symphony Orchestra here, and probably in other cities as well, but I know the CSO, which is you come try out to be a cellist or a violinist. You're behind a screen, and all of those making the decisions can hear is the music. And why couldn't we do that with college admissions? You're randomly assigned a number. You've got the full academic record of the prospect, and college admissions officers are making decisions based on the evidence in the file and no other consideration.
I think there are certain things about that plan that makes a lot of sense. The problem is finding the right metric, the right sort of academic record. And the way that a lot of institutions, when they do try to be blind to everything else that's going on in students' life, they tend to favor SAT and ACT scores as the one sort of objective measure of a student's ability. And the reality is that those scores are highly correlated with family income. I spent a lot of time in my reporting with this very high-paid SAT tutor in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., He was getting $400 an hour from these affluent parents, and I was watching him, you know, totally legally help these students increase their ACT scores by 5 or 6 or 7 points. So if that is the objective measure that we're, that these behind-the-screen admissions officers were using, it would already be skewed.
Although you have more and more colleges discarding an SAT-ACT requirement to apply.
That's right. So there are more institutions that are not necessarily discarding it, but going test optional, giving students the option of applying without test scores.
I'm sure you're watching the Varsity Blues scandal unfold. And did you think 14 days was enough, not enough for Felicity Huffman?
Good question. I feel like it's hard for me to be judge and jury, but that it seems pretty reasonable. I mean, I think it is definitely a crime, and it makes sense that she would be punished. More than that seems like a little too much. So I feel like that was a pretty reasonable sentence.
And did you, as you watched that unfold, did that speak to what you're saying? And that elite parents like Felicity Huffman and William H. Macy, they know that their kid getting into an elite university, if USC is considered one of those, I don't know. I don't think so, but maybe it is. I don't know. But they understand the premium that comes with getting into an elite university. And so it was rational, if not ethical, for them to try to rig the system to their kids' advantage.
Yeah, I mean, it's, in a lot of ways, I feel like the Varsity Blues scandal was just the most extreme example of the kind of madness that I think has taken over a lot of affluent parents. And there are, far short of breaking the law, there are all of these unfair advantages that affluent parents have. And I think when they look at that system, they just feel like, well, there are no rules. Everyone else around me is bending the rules in some way or another. Why not just go this extra step? I mean, clearly going that extra step was breaking the law, and they're suffering the consequences now. But I can understand the mindset. I think it's quite prevalent.
Going back to that paragraph that I read, excerpted from your book about this, like the small percentage of Pell Grant eligible undergrads at places like Virginia and University of Michigan, University of Alabama, you may have expected at Princeton and some of these other places, but less so some of the state schools. Is there a change at all? Is there a conversation within admissions offices about diversity that includes socioeconomic diversity?
There's definitely a conversation going on. I think more and more administrators and especially admissions people are trying to figure out a way out of this. I mean, the people, if you go into admissions, if you go into higher education administration, you don't think of yourself as wanting to just serve rich kids. And yet I think a lot of them are realizing that's a lot of what they do day to day. So there is this push for change. The problem is that the problems in the system go pretty deep. And with those public institutions, it really is about public funding. We've just shifted, as a nation, we've shifted the burden of higher education just over the last couple of decades from the public, the way that we used to think about public higher education, onto individual students. And when you do that, higher education becomes a consumer good rather than a collective good. And once that happens, the slots are going to go to the highest bidder. So the change, I think, that has to happen isn't just in higher education. It's more broadly in terms of funding.
Paul Tough, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, the book, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. And he's got two appearances in Chicago tonight at the Latin School, 7 o'clock in their Wrigley Theater. Tomorrow night at Harold Washington Library with noted author as well, Alex Kotlowitz. Paul, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, 24 shot, 8 dead this weekend in Chicago weekend violence. In recent months, 900 gun offenders have been allowed out of jail, either on their own recognizance or with a bracelet. Tony Preckwinkle was at the City Club. Grady, Tony Preckwinkle, the Cook County Board President. Can't seem to get on the same page with the mayor. Can't seem to get on the same page with the state's attorney.
Was she still bitter about the mayoral race, or have they put that beside them?
Well, whatever it is, it doesn't bode well for public safety. Preckwinkle claims less than 1% of gun offenders out on bond or their own recognizance are rearrested for committing crimes. Well, Ben Bradley over at WGN, to his credit, took a look at that and finds out that's not exactly true.
Every Monday, like clockwork, police promote their efforts to get illegal guns off the streets. Today, it was the arrest of these five people after a gang search warrant netted two guns, including an AR-15 and a handgun converted to fire full automatic. Citywide this weekend, cops collected 84 illegal guns.
Well, you know, I think it's important to understand, you know, where we are in terms of the violence.
Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle is defending a bail reform program that police say allows too many people arrested with guns to get out of jail in a matter of hours or days.
99%+ of the people who are out on electronic monitoring or their own recognizance are not rearrested for a violent offense. It's more than 99%, so less than 1%. Of the people who are released on their own recognizance or electronic monitoring are picked up for a new violent offense.
Chicago police data tell a different story. In the last 4 months, 892 people arrested on a felony gun charge were able to post bond, even though roughly half had previous felony gun arrests. 75 have since been rearrested. That's a 12% rearrest rate for those on bond.
So Preckman goes only off by a factor of 12. That's pretty good for Chicago, Cook County government, isn't it?
No.
Factor of 12. Disgusting. Also, half of those had previously been arrested, half of the 900 previously arrested on felony gun charges. So tell me again that your gun banning proposals and your gun banning rhetoric is about getting serious with respect to criminals who commit crimes with a gun. Yeah, I want to understand how you can have this laissez-faire attitude towards felonious gun offenders and then turn around, take to the lectern and beat your shoe about gun banning, which of course is directed at the otherwise law abiding. I mean, does
it gonna stop?
I mean, who anybody awake for this? Are we also numb in Chicago that we're not only inert to the violence, we're inert to the incompetence and the intentional deceit of the political class as represented by Preckwinkle and Fox and Lightfoot? I mean, it's just remarkable.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.